16. 9:47 p.m. November 13, 2018. Memory Care Unit. Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility. Braidwood, Illinois. Every time Matilda walked into the Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility, she felt a deep pang of regret. Sometimes she'd sit in one of the upholstered armchairs near the front desk and watch visitors sign in as the harried receptionist, a young woman with tattoos on her neck, fielded a near-constant barrage of texts from her zebra-cased cell phone. Most of the visitors were like Matilda, adult children, seeing their frail and forgotten parents. The ones who visited the most often, the weeklies, even dailies, had a businesslike demeanor. They were checking emotional boxes, following up on promises they had made when their parents' minds were stable. The people who came by a few times a year, the children who lived out of state, or just couldn't stomach seeing the destruction Alzheimer's had wrought, arrived with stuffed animals and flowers. They brought in framed pictures of grandchildren and mementos. Burdened by their loss, these visitors dreamed of somehow shaking their loved ones from their long, long slumber. Only it never happened. Once gone mentally, there was no coming back. Matilda didn't know where she fell on the visitor spectrum. She came to see Lucy 3 times a week, and she often brought meals. Every now and then, she'd bring a gift. Jewelry, flowers, little things she'd pick up at the Friday art market in Daly Plaza. Yet despite the frequency of her visits, Matilda still reacted emotionally when she came through the front doors. She cringed. A lump would form instantly in her throat. It wasn't that the fake cinnamon and vanilla smell of the place, or the dark furniture and dim lighting, conjured up nostalgic memories. It was because she knew Stony Brook was a way station. Life inside its carefully temperature-controlled walls provided a temporary, gentle easing into the infinite dark waters of death. And everyone who walked through its doors could sense it. Matilda knew it was different in other countries. People died at home, not in quiet simulacrums of domestic life. Her friend and colleague, Tomiko, a neuroscientist at the university, had told her that in Japan and other Asian countries, the elderly moved in with their children. They cared for their grandchildren, cooked and cleaned. And when they grew frail or demented, their children took care of them in turn. When the end came, it almost always came at home, surrounded by family. After Matilda signed in at the front desk, she grabbed a freshly baked almond butter cookie from a tray beside the coffee and water pitcher. She ate it as she made her way through the lobby, where two women, Francine and Rosa, frequently sat across from each other and watched TV. As Rosa knitted, Francine thumbed through a 3-decade-old issue of National Geographic with a photo of a scuba diver on the cover. As she walked past, Matilda waved. "Any luck on the article?" Matilda asked.
"Not yet," Francine frowned. "But I think I'm getting closer."
2 weeks earlier, while Matilda was waiting for Lucy to finish a rehab session, Francine explained that she was going through the 75-plus back issues left behind by another resident. Francine was looking for an article from the mid to late 1980s about a shooting at a nursing facility. The story had haunted her, and she was desperate to read it again. Francine often joked that she had a morbid streak. Thinking on it, Matilda didn't recall ever reading an article like that in National Geographic. It seemed to be outside the magazine's purview. She suggested that perhaps the article was in Time or Life. Francine was certain it was in National Geographic. Matilda found Lucy in her bedroom. Lucy was 70 years old, tall, very thin, and had let her hair grow out to shoulder length. She wore smudged glasses. When she was younger, in Matilda's earliest memories of her mother, Lucy kept her hair cut short around her slightly cherubic face. Lucy had always looked at least 10 years younger than she was. Baby-faced, people called it. Lucy hated the phrase. Lucy didn't look up when Matilda walked in.
"I can't find it," she said,
hand scouring the clothing in the top drawer of her dresser.
It was there yesterday. I saw it just before dinner.
What are you looking for, Mom? Lucy looked up, a bit confused. Her eyes played across Matilda's face, as if she were trying to sync the features with the few memories she still had. For a split second, it looked as though Lucy was going to smile, to walk over to Matilda, and melt into a hug. But the look of recognition passed, just as quickly as it had arrived. Frowning, shaking her head, Lucy turned back to the task at hand.
Can I help you?
It's a brooch, Lucy said. My aunt gave it to me.
Aunt Deborah, Matilda said. It's at the bank.
Lucy looked up, eyes quivering.
Matilda, you're here?
Matilda took Lucy's hand in her own, squeezed them.
The brooch is at the bank, in a safety deposit box, with Grandma Helen's jewelry and Dad's papers. It's all there, all protected.
Have you eaten dinner? Lucy glanced over at the clock on her wardrobe. I wasn't hungry earlier, she said, before turning again to the dresser.
I just was so certain I saw my brooch this afternoon.
You wouldn't believe some of the problems we've been having here recently. The woman next door. Lucy lowered her voice.
The woman next door has been stealing things.
Mom, no one is stealing from you.
She has been. I woke up in the middle of the night. There was a noise in my room, and I saw her. She was right here, going through the drawers, looking for valuables. I got up and I yelled at her. She screamed back at me and scratched my arm. Right here. Scratch me with her nails.
Lucy pulled up the sleeve on her sweater to show Matilda. Her arm was very thin, and her skin mottled with aging bruises, but there was no visible scratch.
It was here. Must have healed already.
This was exactly the thing that killed Matilda. This was why she sometimes stopped and sat at the entrance to Stony Brook to catch her breath. These horrible moments, running on 5 years now, crushed her. Seeing her once strong, once brilliant mother reduced to a paranoid shell filled Matilda with sadness. It went beyond mourning the loss of the woman who shaped her life. Matilda had many years to deal with that loss, and she'd worked through it as gracefully as she could. No, a lot of the exquisite despondency that made her chest tighten came down to seeing her own future. Truth was, she knew that unless she could unlock the chemistry of how memories were formed, stored, and protected, she would follow Lucy into the inescapable maze of forgetting.
Why don't we get something to eat?
The cafe is open for another 15 minutes or so. When I was coming in, I saw they're serving roast beef tonight. Lucy considered.
I do like the roast beef.
As Matilda placed her purse and coat on her mother's bed, she noticed a pile of clothing in the corner of the room. The closet door was open, and the hangers were bare. Every article of clothing, coats, dresses, scarves, and hats, had been unceremoniously dumped onto the floor. Momentarily lucid, Lucy noticed Matilda's worried gaze and walked over. She placed a hand on her daughter's shoulder.
I suppose I got a little carried away, she said. I was sure I saw that brooch.
It took Matilda 5 minutes to get her mother out of the room. Lucy insisted on finding a purse to carry, protesting that she was going to pay for the meal. Matilda couldn't convince her otherwise. Though the purse was empty, save for a few tissues, Lucy happily put it over her shoulder and followed her daughter down a hallway to the dining room, where they sat alone at a table beside a large window. Outside was a small courtyard where medical assistants smoked and checked their cell phones. They made small talk until Lucy detoured into a tirade about the thief she was certain had been stealing stuff from her room. Matilda listened, appreciating her mother's wit and word selections, but ignoring the mentally unbalanced rage and nonsensicalness of it all. She knew Lucy just needed to vent. This was her mother's new reality. It may have been paranoid and confused, but Matilda needed to respect that. For Lucy, the emotions were very real. When they'd finished eating, Matilda escorted her mother back to her room in the memory unit. She helped Lucy into her nightgown and then brushed her hair while Lucy sang old French folk songs, songs she still remembered vividly from her sabbatical in Toulouse in 1984. After tucking her mother into bed, Matilda curled up in a chair. There she fell asleep, watching Lucy's frail chest rise and fall, as her mother drifted into a nostalgia-haunted REM sleep. 17. 10:04 p.m., November 13, 2018. Marcy Lansing Apartments, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanique lay in bed, with her headphones on. No music played, just a muffled white sound. A combination of Ashanique's own breathing and the dull but constant thrum of the city outside. The headphones weren't actually plugged into anything. The jack was tucked under Ashanique's pillow. Janice had gotten the headphone secondhand from a thrift store she passed regularly on her commute home. She and Ashanique went a few times a month, largely for coats and shoes, but frequently eyed the electronics in the glass case by the register. There were the usual decades-old cast-offs, the 5-disc CD player, the ancient Nintendo Game Boy, the portable DVD player with a cracked screen. More and more headphones were showing up. None of the fancy, brightly colored ones Ashanique noticed on the street. But a month ago, when Ashanique saw the ones that were still in the box and advertised noise canceling on the side, she begged her mom to get them. White and black, they cost $50. Janice said she'd think about it, but she stopped by the store on her way home from work a week later and bought them. Though there really wasn't an occasion, she gave them to Ashanique for an early half-birthday. Ashanique was delighted and danced around the apartment wearing them like earmuffs. The Marcy Lansing Apartments were never quiet, and the noise-canceling feature was a godsend. Around 10 p.m. when Ashanique typically went to bed, the noises began. The couple in the apartment right above theirs fought for hours. He'd throw things against the walls. She'd scream and stomp her feet. Sometimes their arguments got so heated that Ashanique would sleep on the couch with a pillow over her head. But it wasn't just the sound from above. At night, the apartment complex seemed to come to life. Once, Ashanique had caught a few minutes of a PBS nature show about the Ecuadorian jungle. In the show, a camera tracked a jaguar as it made its way through a moonlit landscape. The narrator mentioned how loud the tropics got at night, how every nocturnal animal shrieked and chittered and howled as darkness fell. The Marcy Lansing Apartments were the same. All the tensions, all the worries, all the anger that the residents had kept bottled up during the day spilled out when the sun sank from sight. All that tension emerged in shouts and whistles and echoing laughter, in fists pounding against doors, in dog barks in stairwells, in the blare of car horns, and the constant throb of window-rattling bass. For Ashanique, putting on the noise-canceling headphones and then closing her eyes was like falling through a trapdoor into a snowbank of silence, invigorating and simultaneously palliative. After the first few nights of using the headphones, Ashanique began to hear things in the digital hum, voices, songs, bird calls, things like that. At first, the sounds were soothing, like listening to her mom whisper on the phone in the other room. There was a security in the sound, the feeling that, when she closed her eyes, when she let the world just take her, her mom was watching, listening in. But as time went on, the sounds embedded in the white noise took on a more ominous quality. She heard sounds like footsteps, creaking, and laughter. She knew it was just her mind making stuff up, but with George's memories suddenly pouring into her head and other, richer memories right behind, she wasn't so sure anymore. Maybe, she wondered, what she was hearing were the echoes of other people's lives. The door to Ashanique's bedroom opened, and Janice walked in. She sat on the edge of the bed and gently took the headphones off. Hey, baby girl. You doing okay? No cramps or nothing? Ashanique shook her head. And the things you've been thinking?
I'm okay, Mom.
Good. Listen. Janice took a deep breath in and released it slowly, like she had just taken a drag of a cigarette. I think it's about time we moved to a new place. It's loud here. Doesn't exactly have the best neighbors most of the time. Things haven't been so great at work lately, and I thought maybe if we moved out of the city a ways, just for a while we... This is about the doctor who came here, isn't it?
No, hon. I'm not mad about that anymore.
This is about you and me. Things are going to change like I told you. I know you understand. Everything will work out just fine, but it might be a bit crazy for a while. I might be a bit saltier, but you know it's just stress, right? That I don't mean it. It's not personal.
Yeah, Mom.
Ashanique slipped the headphones back on and rolled onto her side. Janice rubbed Ashanique's back, her fingers playing along the girl's spine. After a few minutes, she got up, switched off the lights, and closed the door. With the door closed and her body relaxed, Ashanique fell asleep quickly. Janice woke at 3 a.m. She could hear someone in the hallway outside the apartment. Suddenly, keenly awake, Janice got up off the couch and slipped the Glock 17 out from its hiding place in the bathroom. Safety off, she tiptoed to the front door as silently as possible, her heart already a jumble, her sympathetic nervous system approaching overdrive. Janice peered through the peephole into the darkened hall just outside her front door.
Get ready, girl. They're here.
Two men stood just outside the door. They wore dark coats, but she could see green scrubs beneath. Even with their faces barely visible behind surgical masks, she knew why the men were there and who they were looking for. One of the men pulled a lock-picking kit from his coat and approached Janice's door. Slowing her breathing, she readied the Glock.
Night, doctors.
Those two words pummeled themselves into Janice's brain. More than 20 years on the run, more than 15 different departments, more than a dozen different names, and here they were. She knew it was because of Matilda. And that was because she'd been lazy, gotten too comfortable, too secure.
Now it's come back to bite you in the ass.
There was a trail now, an invisible thread connecting Janice and Ashanique to the outside world. It needed to be severed, and fast. But first, they needed to survive this night. Janice took her finger from the trigger, tucked the gun into the back of her sweatpants, and ran, bare feet padding quietly as a cat's to the bathroom. The number of locks on the door, including a complex magnetic lock, ensured she had a few minutes, maybe even five. Eventually, the night doctors would get frustrated enough to just kick the door down. In the bathroom, Janice removed a loose tile from the wall, reached inside the hole behind it, and pulled out a plastic bag filled with Metrochyme, the pale-colored pills and silver blister packs. Janice stuffed the bag into her pocket and grabbed a windbreaker on her way to her daughter's room. As she passed the front door, the knob rattled. Janice considered putting a bullet in the door and seeing if she hit anyone on the other side, but it was too risky. Janice gently woke Ashanique and covered the girl's mouth.
I need you to grab some clothes and your shoes.
Ashanique went wide-eyed, seeing the Glock in her mother's hand.
I need you to do it as quick as you can, okay?
Ashanique nodded. Janice let her go, and Ashanique got out of bed, an eye still glued to the gun, gathered clothes. Jeans, underwear, two t-shirts. As she grabbed her things, bundling them into a plastic bag from her desk. Janice could hear voices whimpering behind the front door. Her heart raced. Her hand shook from the adrenaline. A ragged noise began like metal being filed against metal, like teeth grinding.
"Who are they?"
Ashanique whispered. Janice just shook her head and put a finger to her lips. As silently as possible, they crept toward the back of the apartment. Then came a sharp, loud rap on the front door. It was not a human fist knocking, but the sound of locks being punched out. Pop, pop. Janice heard the metal locks hitting the floor. The brutal crunch of breaking wood filled the interior of the apartment. Janice imagined that one of the men had grabbed a fire axe from down the hall, and now he was chopping his way inside.
"We need to move fast, baby."
"I'm scared."
"I know, I know."
Janice wrenched open the window behind her bed, overturning the two frail potted plants Ashanique had been trying to revive since she found them in a dumpster 2 months ago. Neither pot shattered, but the thud was obvious. Within seconds, they were on the fire escape. As Janice helped Ashanique through the window and closed it, she looked back and caught a glimpse of the night doctor scrambling into the hallway. They both held knives, long filleting blades that glinted in the half-light like silverfish at the bottom of a murky stream. Janice had seen what those knives could do. Even though she had been a child at the time, the memory was lodged deep in the core of her being. The knife was drawn, it cut the air like a whistle, and then it slid across a perfect expanse of bare flesh, leaving a red and glistening wave in its wake.
"Don't go back there," Janice told herself. "Not now."
Janice turned her attention back to the fire escape. Ashanique was in front of her, scrambling down the rattling metal steps. Janice followed. She did not look back again. When their feet hit the cold asphalt of the alleyway, they ran toward the sounds of traffic. This was the moment she'd spent years preparing Ashanique to face. In fact, they'd played out this very scenario only a week earlier. Janice was proud of how Ashanique held herself, how focused she was. When Ashanique was 6 years old, all her school friends were giggling in gymnastics or taking piano lessons, while she was learning urban survival skills. How to filter and purify water, escape and evasion, handle firearms, and take apart pens to make lockpicks. She would need that strength and training for what was to come. 18. 4:31 a.m. November 14, 2018. Four Seasons Hotel, Chicago, Illinois. Rade stood naked before the floor-to-ceiling mirror, wearing only wireless headphones. Philip Glass's facades played at maximum volume, as Rade scanned his body. He did this every day, though he wasn't particularly vain. He was looking for corruption, for the animal breaking through. The hotel room around him was spotless. He'd inspected it carefully before the room's actual occupant, a businessman from Ohio with sagging jowls and clubbed nails from ulcerative colitis, returned from a dinner at the chain steakhouse across the street. Raid surprised him and, nude, wrestled him to the ground before he broke the fat man's neck between his thighs. He stuffed the man's body into the bed frame beneath the mattress and sprinkled it with the sodium hydroxide he'd ordered from a soap manufacturing supply store. Raid prided himself on being meticulous. He considered his work an extension of himself, the long shadow he cast out into the world. Raid wouldn't go so far as to say what he did was art. He wasn't pretentious. Well, at least not that pretentious. But this thing he did, it was a calling, and he took it very seriously. Staring at his face, violin sawing back and forth to a metronome rhythm in his ears, Raid couldn't help but consider himself handsome. It wasn't the hard edges of his face or the brutalist plugs he called eyes. It was the gravitas. It was the awesome power, a sort of biblical sway that seemed to radiate from him.
"I am the next stage," he told his reflection, crushing the base.
Raid noticed a blonde hair poking up on his left shoulder. It was only visible in direct light, and he had to roll his shoulder to see it properly. Maybe 2 centimeters long. Raid picked up a pair of medical tweezers from the nightstand by the bed. He plucked the hair carefully, ensuring it didn't break off at the root. Holding it tight in the tweezers, Raid examined the hair with the dutiful gaze of a scientist.
This is my battle. Each hair, a soldier to destroy. Each hair, an inch of ground to take back.
To win the war, he just needed to clear the hangers-on from his head. Raid walked the hair over to the toilet, dropped it inside, and flushed it away. As he watched the water spin in the porcelain basin, he ran his hands over his hairless arms. His skin was soft and warm. He touched his face, his fingers tracing the superorbital ridge where his eyebrows had once been. The skin there was so thin. Raid did not consider himself human. It was not something he admitted openly. Raid didn't know what he was exactly. A spirit? A demon? But he was certain that he was trapped in a hairy, vile body. One that sprouted hair in the most unlikely of places. That shed skin and grew useless nails. That oozed foul liquids. One plagued by strange, unnecessary urges. Raid looked out at the world, the civilized world of cities and cars and tablet screens, and saw only apes poking away at technology they didn't understand. He saw gibbering, wide-eyed hordes of animals on the highway, and he cringed at the very thought of being surrounded by them in elevators, malls, and sporting events. Even the best and brightest luminaries of the scientific world or the champions of literature were just less hairy monkeys scratching at ingrown hairs, struggling with bowel movements, and salivating over bulges. No, Raid was sure he wasn't human. He was lighter, cleaner, and more efficient, and he was changing his body, redesigning the brute his mind was trapped inside to become something more. Raid was pushing into the chrysalis stage. Whatever his final form would be, and he had many ideas, ranging from the next stage of human evolution to a being composed entirely of light, it would finally make him feel whole, comfortable, on this planet. Raid returned to the floor-to-ceiling mirror with a duffel bag in one hand and a bowl of hot water in the other. This was his process, his ritual. Facades began again, on a perpetual loop. Watching himself, his movements careful and calculated, he opened the duffel bag and removed a scouring pad and surgical soap. He applied the soap to the pad and then dipped it into the water before he cleansed himself. Every inch of exposed skin was scrubbed. He washed his penis, but had no urge to masturbate. He looked at the organ between his legs, the same way he'd looked at his earlobe. A weird evolutionary adaptation for a bestial creation. Sure, the organ's purpose made sense, and he'd indulged in it in every way imaginable, from the most innocent pleasures to the most decadent horrors. Regardless, he now saw the pinnacle of joy as moving free of his physical form, and that time would come soon. He was sure of it. 22 minutes later, Raid stepped from the shower and toweled off. His skin was bright red, scoured. Raid walked back into the main room and stood naked before the immensity of the night. The moment was broken by the buzz of his cell phone. Returning to the duffel bag, he kneeled down beside it and removed a single latex glove. He pulled it on, slid off his headphones, and entered the cell. "Raid. 51 is on the move," a woman's voice said.
"Where?"
"Washington Park."
"And what is near there?"
"The university. We expect they're heading to the medical center."
"She have the girl with her?"
"Yes." Raid hung up and dropped the cell phone on the bed. As he pulled off the latex glove, he noticed a tremor in his right hand, his index finger twitching with a life of its own. Suddenly furious, Raid grabbed his index finger and twisted it, hard. Ignoring the pain, he closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and let the air out slowly. As his lungs deflated, he refocused himself. In his mind's eye, he saw a clock inside his chest, a series of overlaid gears, each ratcheting into synchronization. When he'd visualized each gear turning in perfect alignment with the gears in front and behind it, Raid opened his eyes. His index finger stopped twitching. Raid walked back into the bathroom and pulled 2 Metrochime capsules from a pill box, tucked into his shaving kit. He chewed them carefully, enjoying the resulting bitter mush. He knew he had to go, back into the morass of humanity, back into the animal fray. Soon, he told himself. Soon. It was only a matter of time before his body's infantile rebellion stopped. Only a matter of time before he could ignore the constant babble of his older selves. Raid was certain his next incarnation would be as a being of light. 19. 6:12 a.m., November 14, 2018. University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. Matilda walked down the hallway to her office, wishing she'd showered. She had a fitful, awful night. Every time the heat kicked on in Lucy's room, the resulting snap-and-rush sound shook her from a sleep, as tasteless and dry as expired crackers. Matilda finally left around 5 a.m. She pulled her mom's blanket up and kissed her on the forehead. Lucy lay still, her lower lip trembling. Matilda was nearly to the highway when she realized she wasn't actually tired. Sore, yes, but very much awake, her brain firing on every neural cylinder it had. She drove to work outside of herself, what psychologists refer to as self-hypnosis, her conscious brain unaware of the traffic or the stoplights, her body in full control of the car, her mind focused on Janice and Ashanique. What is their story? What is Janice hiding? After she'd parked in the garage, Matilda did a cursory search to see if Janice had a social media presence. She found the woman had no digital history at all. Matilda tried the university's electronic medical system. The only thing she turned up was a poorly scanned PDF copy of Janice's signature on a consent to treat form and a HIPAA notification, both collected by Todd 11 months earlier. It was enough to cover her ass if Janice showed up ranting and raving about HIPAA violations and wanted to talk to the review board or file a complaint, but gave her precious little to work with. There was one curious thing. There were timestamps for each instance the PDF had been viewed. While it had remained unmolested for almost a year, someone had looked at it 3 hours before Matilda got to it. Who would look at a consent form in the middle of the night? Reaching her office, Matilda unlocked the door and stepped inside. She was eager to get onto the system from her desktop and see if she couldn't drum up some information on who exactly had access to the PDF and why. With her first class 2 hours away, she figured she had time enough to do some deep digging. She was wrong. Ashanique was sitting in Matilda's chair at her desk. The girl was on her desktop, playing Minesweeper. As Matilda stood there, eyes wide with shock, Ashanique spun around and smiled. That was when Matilda noticed Janice sitting in a folding chair in the corner of the room beside a mountain of file folders. She had a Glock pointed at Matilda.
"Come in. Close the door," Janice said.
"Ashanique, move." Ashanique got up from the chair as Matilda, heart racing, closed the door behind her.
"Janice,"
Matilda said, as she crossed the room to her desk, eyes locked on Janice's. "I know you weren't happy with me talking to—"
"Sit,"
Janice said, motioning with the gun. Matilda sat and turned the chair to face Janice. Ashanique was sitting behind her mother, her face a storm of emotions. In that instant, Matilda understood why Janice appeared to have been erased from the web. She was in hiding, on the run from something, and Ashanique was caught up in her mother's whirlwind. Janice said, I need you to erase everything on the university system about my daughter. Every note you've taken, every medical record. I don't want her name, even her initials, to appear on a single form. Understand?
Yes, Matilda nodded. But Ashanik needs help, Janice.
Not from you. Delete the files.
Matilda looked past Janice at Ashanik. Are you okay? She asked the girl.
Ashanik nodded, though she appeared relatively calm. Matilda could see the anxiety and fear in her eyes. The girl was strong, incredibly brave, but Matilda could tell Ashanik was just barely holding it all together. As much as she prided herself on having a consistently professional mind, there was something about Ashanik that brought out a powerful, almost feral maternal instinct in Matilda. Every fiber of her being joined in a cellular chant. You need to protect this girl.
She's fine, Janice said, sensing Matilda's protectiveness. She turned Matilda's chair back around with her foot. As Matilda locked in, she noticed her hands were shaking. She had never had a gun pointed at her before. That wasn't as disturbing as the steelness in Janice's eyes, however. The way she held the gun, so proficient. For the first time in a very long time, Matilda worried that she was going to die in her office. Previously, she'd imagined that she'd have a heart attack after spending too many grueling weekends grading exams at her computer. But a bullet in the back was something else entirely. She wanted to panic, to scream until security came running and smashed down the door. But she knew that wasn't the way out of this. Stay calm. Just do what they say and breathe. As Matilda logged in, Ashanik glanced up at all the post-it notes. Cautiously, the girl read what she could, gently lifting the papers and looking underneath. As Matilda brought up her patient's database and medical records, Ashanik paused and pointed to Theo Vang's obituary.
I know this man, Ashanik said to Janice.
Matilda shivered.
What? I've seen him, the girl said. In my mind.
Not now, Janice snapped. Let's finish this. She leaned forward and tapped Matilda on the shoulder, pointed to the computer. Ashanik's frightened expression on her mind, Matilda tried to focus on the databases and files, deleting every mention of Ashanik, even if it was de-identified. Though it took only seconds, Matilda dragged the process out as long as she could. She knew a security guard usually rounded her floor around 7. If she could hold Janice off until he showed up, knocking at her door to nod and say good morning, then maybe she'd get Ashanik out of this thing with only a scare.
46 minutes. Come on, you can do it.
Where is the pharmacy? Janice asked.
Downstairs, first floor. But it doesn't open for another half an hour.
We need some medication.
I can't really help you with that.
You have an ID, right? One that opens doors.
Matilda said, but not the pharmacy doors. I'm just research.
We'll see.
Matilda turned around to face Janice. She hoped that her pleading look would be enough to convince Janice that she was serious, that this had to stop here, with no one getting hurt.
Please, Janice, Matilda said. Think of Ashanik.
She shouldn't be seeing this. She should be getting some help.
I know you think you're doing what's right, that you're protecting her, but...
Janice leveled the Glock on Matilda.
Everything I do is for my daughter.
20. As suspected, Matilda's ID didn't unlock the pharmacy door. Matilda had suggested as much, but Janice needed to see it herself. Despite Ashanik's radiating tension and Matilda's shaking hands, Janice was utterly calm. Gun at Matilda's back, she cleared her throat and considered her options.
Someone who works here will be in, Matilda began.
No time, Janice interrupted. Move aside. Matilda stepped to the right as Janice slipped a set of small stainless steel lockpicks from her back pocket. They appeared hand-machined.
Come here, kneel down,
Janice said, motioning to the space between her and the door.
I'm not going to hurt you, but I can't take any risks. Clear?
Matilda, the shaking in her hands getting worse, the fist at the back of her throat, threatening to block her airway completely, kneeled down in front of Janice. As she did, she again caught the trembling fear in Ashanik's eyes. Matilda mouthed,
It'll be okay.
Ashanik didn't appear convinced. As Janice worked, Matilda studied her closely. The woman's nonverbal clues gave away nothing. She was in complete control of her body. Matilda might have chalked it up to drugs, but she suspected it was training. Not military, not gang. The only people she'd seen who were that controlled, that insanely focused, had been new intakes to cult deprogramming sessions. Click. The door unlocked. 23 seconds, and Janice was done. Janice tucked her tools into her pocket and motioned for Matilda to get up. We need a particular drug, okay? Janice said. It's called Metrochime. I'm not familiar with it. You'll look it up in the system. I know they have it here. Matilda led Janice and Ashanik inside, through the tall shelving systems filled with carefully organized bottles, trays, and boxes. Matilda stopped at a computer. Her badge unlocked the home screen, allowing her access to patients' files, but not the pharmacy's dispensing software. Janice stood over Matilda, her impatient energy filling the room. I don't have access to this. Find a way around, Janice said. The drug is for blood cancers. It works on chimeric antigen receptor T cells. It's phase 3. There are trials ongoing here. Check research files. Make it happen, Matilda. Matilda tried to log into the clinical research databases. She'd had access in the past when she was called in on some pediatric trials, but it had been a long time. She doubted her approval was still valid. The passcodes would have been updated as well. Matilda knew it wasn't going to happen. It won't work, Matilda said. Listen, Janice, please just move. Janice shoved the gun into Matilda's face. Ashanik cringed. Fighting the urge to jump up and try and overpower Janice, even if it meant taking a bullet to the chest, Matilda slowly got up out of the chair. There are other ways to get what you want, Matilda said. I can talk to someone in the department. We can get you help. But Ashanik doesn't need to be here. She doesn't need to see you doing this. You need to shut the fuck up, Janice said, as she took the chair. Matilda moved back beside Ashanik, and as she did, their hands touched momentarily. It sent a warm electric sensation up Matilda's arm and over her shoulders. She took Ashanik's hand in her own and squeezed it tight. While Janice's lockpicking skills impressed Matilda, her hacking talents were actually surprising. Janice opened and closed programs with dizzying speed, diving into the guts of the operating system. Matilda's eyes, however, were fixed on the gun. Janice had placed it on the desk beside the computer. Out of her hands, the gun looked smaller, oddly softer. Matilda couldn't stop her brain from conjuring up scenarios where she swiped the weapon to the floor and kicked it away, or even more ludicrous, where she grabbed the gun and leveled it at Janice. As each scenario played out on the membrane screen of her mind, she asked herself, would you pull the trigger? Would you kill this woman in front of her daughter? Does it matter? This is your only chance. You want to live, right? Matilda found herself shifting her weight forward, her body uncontrollably pushing itself toward the gun. Unit 15, shelf 201, Janice said, grabbing the gun and spinning from the computer, as Ashanik pulled her hand from Matilda's grip. Unit 15 was in the far left corner of the room, near the refrigerated medications. Janice found shelf 203, a few feet off the floor. The Metrochime was two shelves below. Janice grabbed two marked boxes and opened them. Stuffing blister packs of the drug into her coat pockets, Janice paused to hand a few back to Ashanik. The girl put them in her pants pocket. No, baby, Janice said. You need to take two right now. Matilda interrupted,
This is experimental. She stopped when Janice again stuck the Glock in her face.
You shut up. Take them, baby.
Ashanique pushed two of the yellow and white capsules through the silver blisters covering them. Janice kept the barrel of the handgun steady, inches away from Matilda's forehead.
They don't taste too bad, Janice told her daughter. Just go ahead and put them in your mouth and chew them up. You'll feel better right away.
Eyes on Matilda. Ashanique placed the capsules in her mouth. Matilda nodded to her, hoping to project stoicism.
It's okay, she whispered.
Ashanique chewed the capsules, her face pinched at the bitter taste. Matilda had no idea what the cancer drugs might do, what sorts of side effects they could have. Phase 3 meant they'd made it through animal testing and a small cohort of human research. It meant Metrochime, whatever it actually was, had been approved for more extensive clinical testing. But none of that meant that it was safe. Matilda knew that only a quarter of drugs actually made the move from phase 3 to general sale to the public. And chances were this T-cell receptor cancer drug wasn't approved for use in children. Wheels turning on the assumption that she'd get out of the pharmacy alive, Matilda tried to calculate how long they'd have to pump Ashanique's stomach. At the same time, she knew it was likely that two capsules wouldn't have much of an immediate effect. Even more, Matilda suspected Janice had been taking them herself. How else would she know about the drug? And doubted the woman would purposefully poison her own child. No, Janice surely believed Metrochime worked. But to treat what? The back door to the pharmacy opened.
Matilda?
Matilda's body jumped at the sound of Clark's voice. Janice tightened her grip on the gun. Matilda could see she was readying for the kickback, her shoulders narrowing and her soul going numb.
I can make him go away. Please, trust me, Matilda whispered.
Janice shook her head.
He doesn't have anything to do with this. Please.
Clark's shoes squeaked on the tile floor. Matilda knew exactly which ones they were, the sneakers that he rarely wore, the ones his daughter Amanda told him were hip. Clark thought they were too shiny, too brightly colored, and told Matilda he worried people would look at him and assume he was some midlife crisis sap, desperate to hold on to his rear-view mirror youth. She didn't have the heart to tell him he was right. That was exactly how the shoes looked.
Yo, Maddie. You back there?
Maddie. God. Clark, please be careful.
Janice nodded to Matilda.
Make him leave.
Thank you. Thank you.
Not wasting a millisecond, Matilda stepped out from between the shelving units. Clark waved to her and walked over, all early morning over-caffeinated smiles.
What the heck are you doing down here? I came in to meet you early like we planned and, saw you vanishing around a corner. Figured I'd follow you down.
Clark looked over Matilda's shoulder.
You with someone? Pharmacy's not exactly open.
Clark, I can't talk right now. Can you meet me in my office?
He read her face, the panic she was trying to hide.
You okay, babe?
Clark said.
Yes, yes. I just... Meet me upstairs.
Matilda didn't see the shadow slide up behind Clark, but she saw the rubber-gloved hand reach across his neck. The sight was so suddenly incongruous that she couldn't process what was happening. She saw a straight razor in the rubber-gloved hand, the folding kind barbers used in old-timey shops, but sleeker, sharper. Eyes bulging, Clark wheezed as the razor drew a perfect red line that bisected his throat. The line opened like a second mouth. It was filled with the brightest blood Matilda had ever seen. Clark folded, his shocked gaze locked on Matilda's.
No, no, no.
Matilda wanted to scream. She wanted desperately to explode in panic, but she was utterly immobilized with horror. There was a man in a hoodie and tapered athletic pants standing just behind Clark. He was extraordinarily bald, and his skin gleamed in the buzzing fluorescence like a freshly waxed bowling lane.
He winked at Matilda.
Where's 51?
21. Like most people, Matilda had mentally toyed with terrifying moments. She'd indulged in weird daydreams born of bad headlines that quickly twisted into survival fantasies. Every time she'd played out the scenarios, whether in the midst of a mass shooting or being chased by an armed man, she took risks, bold risks, to ensure her own survival. But that moment when the threat actually materialized in hideously cold reality, when the blood was pumping like thunder in her ears, she thought only of Ashanique.
Run!
Before the man in the hoodie could so much as wink again, Matilda spun and ran back toward the aisle where Ashanique was huddled. Janna stood in front of the girl, the Glock aimed at Clark's killer. Without a word, she pulled the trigger. Matilda ducked and turned to see the bullet slam into a cabinet to the right of the man. Despite the shot, he continued walking toward Janice.
You have to run,
Matilda said, as she stumbled over to Ashanique and grabbed her arm. Then she turned to Janice.
We need to go right now.
Ignoring Matilda, Janice fired again. The man in the hoodie dodged right. The bullet screamed past him.
Please, Janice, we have to go.
The man in the hoodie picked up speed, began running toward Janice. Seeing the predatory expression on his face, the cold fire in his eyes, Matilda knew he would not stop. Even with a bullet lodged in his lungs, if Janice were lucky enough to hit him, he would thunder forward with cosmological certainty.
Get the fuck out of there!
Matilda dragged Ashanique toward the front door to the pharmacy. The girl was crying, her head turned back toward her mother, but she didn't slow. Matilda knew there was an alarm by the entrance, one she could trigger with her badge. They'd had so many campus drills, so many intensely boring security presentations, that she knew the stats by heart. Campus police would be on the scene within 3 minutes. However, 3 minutes sounded like nothing when she was in a classroom with 100 other restless employees. But when a killer was chasing her with a blade, it quickly became a lifetime. For a moment, Matilda thought about how she'd tell Clark about the morning's encounter. She imagined him putting a shock blanket over her shoulders while she sat in the back of an ambulance, the way loving people do on television. But then, images of Clark's open throat, his desperate eyes flashed before her.
Jesus, Clark.
Pushing aside the images, Matilda rounded a corner and collided with a medical cart. She remained upright, but the cart smashed back against a wall. Boxes, syringes, and bottles scattering across the tile floor. Reaching the front of the pharmacy, Matilda directed Ashanique to scramble beneath the counter. Stay here. Back as far as you can go. Stay hidden.
What about my mom?
Ashanique asked from under the counter. I'm getting us out of here. Getting us safe.
My mom, Matilda.
Matilda couldn't answer. She needed Ashanique to be focused. They weren't safe yet. Not by a long shot. Matilda swiped her badge on the alarm pad by the door. Sirens instantly screamed to life.
3 minutes,
Matilda repeated to herself.
Just 3 minutes.
Then she ducked down beside Ashanique and wrapped her arm around the girl and held her tight. She wanted to reassure her that she was safe, that the nightmare was over. But she knew she couldn't. So she just enveloped Ashanique and let the girl melt into her, the only safety she could be sure of. Seconds later, Janice barreled around the corner, Glock in hand. She glanced around the room for a moment before ducking down to peek under the counter, her eyes locked with Ashanique's.
I think I hit him, she said. Mom, I don't want to run anymore.
Janice calmly got to her knees and crawled under the counter to her daughter. She took Ashanique's right hand in her own and squeezed it before she leaned in and touched the tip of her nose to the girl's. Ashanique began to cry.
No, baby,
Janice said, gun still gripped tight in her left hand. It's going to be okay. We're going to be just fine. You have to do something for me, though. You have to listen. Can you do that for me?
Yes,
Ashanique said, voice breaking.
Police will be here soon, Janice. Just a couple of minutes.
Janice ignored Matilda, focused solely on her daughter.
What's happening in your head?
The voices, the people. It's only just starting. You have to take the medication every 4 hours. Have to be exact. If you go too long between doses, you'll get a headache. Skip one, and the headaches will get much worse. Miss more than three, and there's no going back.
Ashanique pulled the capsules from her pocket to look at them.
What if I like the memories? What if I want them?
No, baby, Janice said. The memories are bad. Tell me you get that.
Ashanique nodded.
Janice continued, tomorrow afternoon, you need to have Matilda take you to the library at the International Museum of Surgical Science by 4 p.m. Don't forget. You can't be late, okay? Someone named Childers will be waiting there for you. You trust Childers, understand? No one else.
You're going to be there too, right?
Janice bit her lower lip before she kissed Ashanique's forehead. The girl's eyes were turbulent and teary. Janice stabilized them with her own steeled gaze.
I love you, Janice said. Always will.
Mom?
Ashanique squeaked, the sound of her voice crumbling under the weight of pain and distress nearly broke Matilda. She unconsciously wrapped her arm tighter around Ashanique, trying to stabilize the girl against the psychological cataclysm. Janice said, I need you to remember that I love you more than anything. Everything I've put you through, all the moving, all the medications, all the difficulty was because I needed to keep you safe. All I ever wanted was for you to be okay, to live a good life. That is why I have to leave now. Even if you forget what I look like, and you will, remember my love for you.
Ashanique called out as Janice pulled away. Matilda held her back as the alarm shredded the air. As Ashanique screamed and struggled, Matilda watched Janice vanish around a corner. Scattered gunshots quickly followed. With every distant pop, Matilda cringed and Ashanique cried louder.
They'll be here soon, Matilda said. We're safe. We're safe.
She realized she was saying it, almost chanting it, more for herself than for Ashanique. Matilda needed it to be true. She needed to believe this wasn't how her life was going to end. Just a day earlier, every cell of her being was coded with a singular goal, to find the key to memory. Ashanique switched it all up. She was now the only thing keeping Matilda going. That shift, rooted in the primal core of her being, wrenched her focus toward a new goal. You have to save this girl's life.
We're safe. I've got you.
Ashanique's cries subsided, and she settled, but only momentarily. The spasms began with a violent jerk, as the girl suddenly wrenched her head back. Her eyes rolled to white, her teeth chattered. Matilda held her as tightly as she could, worrying Ashanique might bite off her own tongue, and praying, for the first time in a long time, honestly, sincerely praying, security would arrive. Just before she passed out, Ashanique opened her eyes, pupils widening.
I see everything, she said.
Matilda held the girl and whispered half-remembered psalms. You will take refuge under his wing. No harm will come to you. She felt silly saying the words out loud, trying to peel back the decades to find the language that made sense. Matilda wasn't religious, but in that moment, it felt like the only thing to do. There was peace in it. Matilda heard more gunfire, then shouting, running. Seconds later, campus police officers appeared. Guns drawn, the radios at their hips rattled with static and panic. An officer with light brown eyes crouched down by the pharmacy counter and looked over at Matilda and a limp Ashanique.
It's over, she said. You're safe now.
22. 1:34 p.m. August 23, 1662. Patna Mughal Dynasty, India. Running. Heart pumping, tunnel blind. Branches whip the young boy's face as he races down the narrow trail. Other hunters are close behind him. He hears his uncle's rapid breathing. The musky scent of the tiger is strong, hanging like vapor over the trail. He sees its tail in every creeper, its stripes in every shadow. This is his moment, his to own. Around him, the forest pushes in. Birds call and scatter. Monkeys shriek in the low-hanging branches. The trees buzz with life. Every leaf hides an insect. Beneath every stone, a snake. The hunters know this trail, but not like the boy. He spent his life memorizing its turns and straightaways, navigating each stone and root. The boy is 12 today. His celebration is this hunt. He wears a simple length of fabric tied about his hips. In his hands is the push dagger his uncle made for him. It has never pierced flesh, but the young boy is anxious to use it. In his mind, if he kills this tiger, he will be a strong man like his father. If he fails, he will be a simple villager. He's seen how their lives are measured by their kills. The boy's bare feet slap against the hard soil as he carefully dodges every approaching obstacle. The boy and the hunters run through a field of shoulder-high grass before scrambling after the tiger as it winds its way down the rocky side of a steep gorge. A river churns far below. The hunters stop at the edge of the gorge, but the boy follows the tiger down. He is fleet, his balance uncanny. Reaching the waterline, the boy jumps over the boulders, slick with moss and washed by constant waves, before cornering the tiger in the roots of a vine-choked tree. The hunters egg the boy on from above. He pulls his push dagger from his knotted sarong. The beast flashes its teeth and hisses. Heart racing, breath caught in his throat, the boy moves closer. The tiger lashes out with razor-tipped paws. The boy dodges but catches a claw on his thigh. It leaves a long, paper-thin gash. The boy stabs with the tiger. The tiger lunges. It slams into the boy, and the watching hunters shout as both tiger and boy tumble into the fast-moving river. They are swept into the river, tumbling head over feet in the choppy, dark water. 2 miles downstream, the river widens and slackens. The boy is the first to claw his way out onto the muddy bank. He rolls over, hacking up lungs full of water, and stares back at the river. Birds flock overhead. Their screeching, echoing through the jungle. The boy's heart slows. His breathing steadies. He is just pulling himself up when he sees the tiger paddling toward him. The boy freezes. It shakes off the water, eyes locked on him. The boy doesn't dare turn his head. The tiger growls once before leaping over the boy and vanishing in the forest behind him. The boy falls backwards and sighs. The sun is reflected in his dark eyes, just as... 23. 7:17 a.m., November 14, 2018. University of Chicago Medicine, Chicago, Illinois. The boy's eyes became Ashanik's eyes. The tiger and the river and the forest melted away, and all she saw were the bright lights of the ceiling spinning overhead like exploding constellations. She found herself lying in a hospital bed with an IV in her arm. The clear tape used to keep in the IV hurt. Her skin was stretched around it, and the blood under the tape, a tiny puddle smushed flat, discolored her skin. Ashanik was alone. The door was closed. Outside, she heard nothing. As though the very planet had stopped moving. Wherever she was, it seemed safe. Safe enough. Ashanik closed her eyes for a few moments and replayed the jungle chase. As it came rushing back, her pulse quickened. The jungle foliage crushing in. The tiger jumping at her. its teeth flashing before. A bomb explodes. Clods of dirt fly skyward. A British soldier falls, mouth gushing blood. Ashanique's eyes snapped open. She had to breathe slowly to calm her pulse, to stop her heart from bursting like a rabbit's. Calming down, she looked around the room. It was small. The bed enclosed by all manners of medical equipment. Some of it on, most of it not. Despite the presence of the machines, deep down coiled somewhere in her chest was the soft, glowing feeling of knowing she was not sick. No matter what Matilda said, no matter what the doctors who hooked her up to the machines thought, she wasn't sick. Not sick like someone with cancer or a brain disease. Whatever was happening to her was organic, a process that felt determined and inevitable, but at the same time familiar, intimately so. Whatever was coming to life in her was integral. Ashanique also knew intrinsically, inexplicably, that her mother was out there, alive, and that the bald man with no eyebrows was coming to kill her. He had come for her mom. Ashanique was next on the list. The night doctors always found their patients. That is why Mom told you to run. Why she told you never to trust anyone except Childers. Go to the museum. Get there by sunset tomorrow. With her uneasiness quickly rising, Ashanique pulled up the edge of the tape over her IV. The skin came up with it. The tiny, invisible hairs, too. It hurt, and the flesh around the IV was quickly turning red. But Ashanique knew she didn't have a choice. She had to push through the pain. Gritting her teeth, she pulled the tape away from her wrist. The IV came out with the tape, the long catheter emerging with a bubble of blood. Ashanique staunched the wound with the edge of the pillowcase. Then she swung her legs around the edge of the bed and got up. She was woozy for a moment. The last rivulets of blood running down her arm tickled. Ashanique found her clothes in a bag on a chair in the corner of the room. Dropping the pillowcase, she slipped onto the thin hospital gown and into her clothes. Fully dressed, shoes slipped on, she peeked outside into the hallway. It was empty. Moving quickly, eyes to the ground, Ashanique walked out of her room and into the hall. She headed to her right, hugging the halls with her shoulder. Though she had no idea where she was going, she assumed this hospital was like most hospitals. Stairs and elevators would be readily available. The hallway ended, branching to the left and right. But 20 feet away, directly across from her, was a service elevator. It could only be accessed with a badge or a key, and there was an armed security guard standing in front of it, distractedly looking at something on his cell phone. Ashanique mentally replayed the image of the bald man splitting open Matilda's friend's throat. She replayed the heavy gush of blood. She replayed the bald man's emotionless expression, his merciless speed. Ashanique had to get into that elevator. The intersection was busy. There was a nurse's station to her right, where two men and a woman, all clad in green scrubs, sat and talked. To her left, a man restocked a cart stacked high with folded bed linens. He had earbuds in and was nodding his head in time to a silent beat. Ashanique figured she'd just walk over as calmly as possible, press the call button, and hope the guard left her alone. It was risky.
What if he notices you? Asks you what you're doing? How are you going to talk your way past him? Think, silly. Come up with something good. Something believable.
Ashanique remembered the Indian boy and the tiger. While his memories didn't surge back, the sensation of him did. Looking over at the security guard, her eyes tracking his movements, she noticed subtle things about him. The fact that one of his shoulders slouched lower than the other. That he had coffee stains on his pants and orthopedic shoes. Things she never would have noticed 2 days ago. Things she never would have cared about. But now, here, she saw them, and put them together as though she were assembling a puzzle.
You're going to take him.
A voice inside her head said,
"He'll drop easy."
Ashanik unconsciously balled her hands into fists. She was a passenger in her own body. Someone else, someone older, someone dangerous had taken over. The voice was strong, cold.
"You bring the guard down and then get into the elevator. If you hurry, we can be out of here before the alarms even go off. You need to find Childers. Dr. Song can help you. He can help all of you and stop the Night Doctors and their killer."
Ashanik moved, every muscle taut, ready to spring. But just as she crossed the carpeted intersection, the security guard's radio blurted a static fart. He grabbed it and walked away talking, never even noticing her. But Ashanik was in motion now. As she walked to the elevator, Ashanik grabbed a ballpoint pen from on top of a crash cart, parked against a wall nearby. With each step, she took the pen apart. Unwinding the pen's tightly coiled spring to pick the elevator lock, Ashanik stepped up to the elevator, hands unnaturally still. A heartbeat before she inserted the unwound spring, the doors whooshed open. Two doctors stood inside, staring at her. Both wore blood-splattered scrubs and medical masks.
"Night Doctors."
Ashanik didn't think. She didn't plan what happened next. Her body simply reacted. She swung the pen's ink cartridge hard into the first doctor's side, embedding the sharp tip of the pen in between his ribs, like a small black arrow. The doctor screamed and collapsed backward into the elevator. But Ashanik didn't see that. She'd already turned, already started to run in the opposite direction, right into Matilda. Seeing Matilda's face was like seeing the shore after being dragged, tumbling by a riptide, out into the dark sea. Ashanik ran to that shore, her composure breaking down, her strength crumbling away with every emotion-choked breath. Matilda opened her arms to Ashanik.
"It's okay. I've got you." "I need to get out of here. He's coming for me."
"You're safe," Matilda said. "You're safe here. The doors are locked, and the guards are on every floor."
"I got out of my room easy."
Matilda looked over Ashanik's shoulder at the elevator, where several nurses were helping the injured doctor over to a chair. Security guards, their radios a riot of robot voices, raced over, eyes pointed in Ashanik's direction.
"The man isn't here anymore. The police are after him, okay? And my mom?"
"I promise you, they're looking for her as hard as they can. As soon as the police hear something, they'll tell us." Ashanik let go of Matilda and turned to the elevator. She watched as a nurse pulled the pen from the doctor's side.
"She's going to be okay, right?"
"I'm sure she will." Three security guards, hands on their weapons, were walking over. Ashanik looked at Matilda, eyes swimming with tears.
"I didn't mean to hurt him. I thought he was one of them. You understand, right? Please, please tell them that I didn't mean it, that I'm just so confused."
Matilda waved off the security guards. "Just give us a minute, please," she said. The guards stopped a few feet away. Matilda kneeled down and Ashanik followed. Heads close, eyes locked, Matilda said,
"Do you need to talk?"
"Yes, but not here."
"I understand," Matilda said. "Are you hungry?" Ashanik nodded.
"Great."
Matilda looked down at Ashanik's wrist. She noticed the oozing bruises where the IV used to be.
"The doctor's going to be okay. It was just a misunderstanding. You've been through,
well, you've experienced something this morning that most people never see and shouldn't. You saw it too. It was your friend."
Matilda nodded, swallowing hard. Ashanik watched a single tear form in the corner of Matilda's eye. As it slid down her cheek, the girl reached up and wiped it away. Matilda smiled.
"Do they have pancakes here?"
Ashanik asked.
"Yes, very good pancakes. Can we go?"
Matilda stood.
"Yes, we can go."